So the topic tonight is Bible Objections Answered, Part 1. And tonight we want to take up three different questions from the Bible that people are asking out there in the culture. Let's look at those, see what those are. The first is going to be that the Gospels were written in Greek, but Jesus spoke Aramaic. The Gospels were written in Greek, but Jesus spoke Aramaic. How do we answer this question? How do we deal with these two different languages, from the spoken word to the written word? We'll talk about that. And then secondly, we'll talk about Paul and the nativity. One of the objections that people have is they will say, well, Paul never mentions the nativity, you know, Jesus in the manger and all of that. So did Paul know? How do you answer that? And then thirdly, we're going to deal tonight with the objection that the New Testament books were chosen at Nicaea. I'll talk to you a little bit more about what that means, but essentially there's an argument out there that several hundred years after Jesus was resurrected, the books of the New Testament were filtered by the Catholic Church. And so people have an issue with that, and they're wondering about that. So we want to answer these three tonight. We won't take a long time to do each, but we are going to hit these. So let's talk about our first one then. The Gospels were written in Greek, but Jesus spoke Aramaic. So it is true that Jesus and the apostles in Palestine probably spoke Aramaic and not really Greek. Greek was the language of the Roman Empire. Aramaic was a form of Hebrew that developed over many years. And so it is true that Jesus, and likely the early apostles, many of them, spoke Aramaic. But the New Testament, as we know, its original language was Greek. And so the objection here is, hey, you're not even reading Jesus' words. How is it that you Christians think you know what Jesus said when you're not even reading his words? He didn't even speak Greek. He spoke Aramaic. Well, it's quite possible that Jesus did know Greek. I mean, Greek was the ruling power in Palestine at the time. But more than likely, yes, it is true. Jesus spoke Aramaic. But is it true then that if we are reading Jesus' words in Greek, that we are not understanding Jesus' true words that he spoke in Aramaic? Let's take a look at this. First of all, let's ask ourselves, why Greek? Why did the New Testament authors choose to write their Gospels and the books of the New Testament in Greek and not Aramaic? Well, if you'll think about their charge was to take the Gospel into all the world. Well, if you're going to go into the world at that time, what the universal language that almost everybody spoke was Greek, because it was the language of the Roman Empire. Greek was the language of the Romans, and the Romans controlled the known world. So that would be the most widely spoken and the most widely understood language in the world. If Jesus were to be born today, of course he's not, but if he was and he lived in this present age, and let's say that he was born in, let's just pick somewhere, Argentina, all right? More than likely, we would be wise to translate his words into English, because most of the world speaks English, because it's the language of business, it's the language of the world, because the major power is the United States. So we would want that to get into their hands as quickly and easily as possible. So Greek makes perfect sense. So Greek is not some kind of, they didn't choose this in some kind of a conspiracy. They chose it because it fit within the parameters of their charge, which Jesus himself gave them. So that's why Greek. But the real question isn't why Greek. The real question that we're asking here is, can one language be accurately translated into another? That's the crux of the issue here. Can we reliably take Jesus' words in Aramaic, which the apostles heard in their own ears? They were eyewitnesses. And can we translate that into another language, in this case Greek, and get a good translation and be able to trust that we understood Jesus' words as he originally spoke them? And the answer is absolutely. I've talked about this in some other sessions, but let's go back and review the structure of language. The reason that this is possible is because of the nature of language. And people who are objecting to this don't understand language very well, and that's why they ask this question, because they are missing the point that if you don't have his actual words in Aramaic, then you don't have his words. That's not true. Let's look at the twofold structure of language. Language has a surface structure. The surface structure is the words. So for example, if I were to say, that's a cool car, those are the words that I am using. That's the surface structure. But the deep structure and what we are actually understanding in language is meaning. And I still have to use words to express the meaning. But if I were to say, that's a cool car, then what I am saying, the meaning is, I like your car. It's a nice car. It's a cool looking car. Whatever words you want to use, that's the deeper meaning that I'm trying to get to. And it is because of this twofold structure that I can take the words of one language, that surface structure of Aramaic, I can understand the deep structure, the meaning, and then I can turn around and translate those words into Greek and have an accurate translation. Because what we are translating is ideas, not necessarily words. We're using the words to get to ideas, and then the ideas to get to a new set of words. When we are communicating through language, written or spoken, we are not actually communicating words. Words are not what we are communicating. Ideas, thoughts, those are what we are communicating. Let me show you here. Let's say these two people are trying to communicate with one another. This one guy, he has a thought, he has an idea, or he has a concept that he wants to communicate to his friend. He wants his friend to understand his thought, his idea, or his concept. And so he chooses words. He tries to put those into words. And sometimes you can see people say this. I'll do it often. I'll say, how do I say this? What am I doing? I have a thought. I have an idea, a concept, but I don't know exactly what words to choose to get this idea across to you. So let's say that he chooses these words, I'm scared of the dark. Those words then are communicated or transmitted to the recipient, the other guy, his buddy. Then that buddy must take those words, that surface structure, and he must then decode it in his mind to come up with the thought, the idea, or the concept that his friend is trying to communicate to him. If he does that properly, then communication has occurred. If he does it improperly, communication has not occurred. He might have to say, well, what do you mean by that? I don't understand. Do you see that? So it is because of this that language can be accurately translated. And one of the gentlemen that was bringing up this objection on YouTube, I pointed out to him that he accepts translations as valid all the time. He just doesn't know it. For example, I'm pretty sure that this guy was an evolutionist, and so he probably looked up to scientists of the past, like Copernicus. Well, Copernicus wrote a very famous and influential book in the 1500s called, and I'll try my best here on the Latin definition or Latin title, De Revolutionibus Orbium Coelestium. Yeah, say that five times in a row. It means On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres in English. That's the title. But what I pointed out to him was that it was first published in Latin in 1543. So if he understands the thoughts and ideas and principles that Copernicus discovered, he understands it because it has already been translated into his language. So he's being critical of the New Testament because it translated Jesus from Aramaic to Greek, but he is accepting other documents that have been translated as if there's no problem. And he was forced to accept this argument. He actually acknowledged that that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Here's another one. Einstein's theory, special and general theories of relativity, which we're so familiar with in our culture today. E equals mc squared is one of the formulas that flows out of his findings. Well, guess what? That was not originally written in English. That was written in German in 1916, and it wasn't translated until 1920 into English. So you see, we're already accepting that we can translate. We know very well that translation is a valid way to communicate ideas into different languages. Translation has been done successfully for thousands of years. And the fact that Jesus' words were translated does not affect their reliability whatsoever. We can have an accurate translation. And we can understand Jesus' words in all the different languages of the world because we can translate due to the nature of language itself. So that is not a valid objection. Let's turn now to our second objection. The objection that Paul never mentions the nativity in his writings in the New Testament. The argument is really what Paul doesn't say. And the skeptics would mention, they would say that Paul does not directly mention Jesus' virgin birth or the details surrounding it, the nativity as we see it. You know, it's a big part of our culture in America, the nativity. We put nativities up at Christmas. We fight over nativities in public spaces. We've got baby Jesus in the manger and the three wise men and all of that. That's a big, in our culture, that's a big sort of visual image at Christmas. But the objection is, well, look, Paul doesn't mention this. This is a big thing. How is it that Paul didn't mention it? Did he not even know about it? And so the idea here is you can see the skeptic's mind is working. The skeptic is going, Paul didn't mention this. The Gospels mention it. Huh, maybe Paul's writings were first. Most of his writings came before the Gospels, depending on how you date things. It's difficult to know the exact dates. But the idea is, well, look, Paul wrote some of his stuff first. He didn't know about the nativity. Later on, the apostles write their Gospels. They made it up. That's what it was. Paul didn't know about it because it was made up. Let's deal with this. Did Paul not know about the nativity? And is this a valid argument for the unreliability of the Bible? A few considerations here. First of all, Mark and John don't include any details on it either. Keep that in mind. Two of the four Gospels don't give us that nativity account, that the story, the factual story of what happened at Jesus' birth. So are we going to say that those two Gospels are not valid either? Or is there another reason they might not have focused on that in their Gospels? Secondly, remember that Paul only mentioned the Lord's Supper once. We talk about the Lord's Supper. That's one of the basic doctrines of the Christian faith. It's one of the ordinances, we call it, or rules or laws that we're supposed to practice the Lord's Supper, the bread and the wine. But he only mentions that one time. Did he not think that was important? Did he not know about that? There's nobody doing it, you see? Why didn't he mention that? And it really comes down, this third point here is very important. What we have to realize is that we talk about Mark and John not detailing it. We talk about Paul only mentioning the Lord's Supper once and not giving the details. It is true, Paul didn't give an account of the nativity. He didn't say, you know, all these things happened and the three wise men and all of that. He didn't do that. But what we have to realize is the New Testament authors, they were living in a time of dynamic early Christianity. The church was getting started, the faith was moving out freshly into the world, and they were dealing with all kinds of issues. The gospel writers, it's clear that when they wrote their gospels, they are writing to different audiences. They are writing to accomplish different kinds of purposes. That doesn't mean that they were not telling truth about Jesus and the accounts of his life and his words. It simply means that they were choosing things out of Jesus' teaching, choosing things out of Jesus' life that served the purpose that they had in their writing. You know, I'm an author. I like to write books. And one thing I've learned about writing, and it's true of speaking too, you cannot write everything there is to be written about everything. And it's hard for preachers, but we can't preach everything that needs to be preached every time we speak. You have to cut down what you're including, what you're talking about. Even when you're quoting a verse, sometimes I will take out parts of that verse that don't apply to what I'm trying to get across because it's only going to confuse the reader or the hearer, the listener. And I don't want to spend the time on that. I'm just focusing on this part of the verse, not that part. So Paul was facing, he was going around establishing churches, and he is dealing with all kinds of practical problems, day in and day out, trying to solve problems. So his books were not written as these long, verbose, end-all, be-all accounts of everything possible in Christianity. He was writing to deal with issues, and he was applying truth and God's Word and God's principles and Jesus' life and Jesus' teachings to help solve and deal with those issues. even in the mention of the Lord's Supper, as I read in one commentary, he's doing that because there was a problem with the Lord's Supper. The way they were carrying on, he needed to address it. So he may not have even mentioned the Lord's Supper directly if he hadn't had this problem. So it's not fair for us to do this. One of the resources I found online, there's a guy named J. Warner Wallace, a website called Cold Case Christianity. And I don't know a lot about this, so I'm not giving a blanket approval or of this website. But he had a very good article on the subject of why didn't Paul mention the virgin conception and the nativity. And he talks about this whole issue of Paul having a purpose in writing and therefore just not needing to talk about it. But in his quote here, he mentions a couple of other things that are very interesting as well. So let's read his quote and let's just consider the points that he's making. He says, we need to be very careful about drawing conclusions from silence. In other words, he's saying, the fact that Paul didn't mention something doesn't mean that he didn't know about it. Like I said, you can't mention everything all the time. Paul may not have mentioned the virgin conception simply because it was widely understood or assumed. Remember, Paul is dealing with problems. He is a fixer. He is the divine fixer. So he's not going to spend his time on something that's well understood, that there's no controversy about or no issue to be discussed. He goes on, Paul may also have been silent because it was not the focus or purpose of his letters, this is what we're talking about, which are often devoted to issues related to the church. So that's the point that we've been making. So he doesn't mention it because everybody understood it and there was no controversy, and it was not the focus of his letters. But he goes on. He says, remember that Paul was a contemporary of Luke. Paul appears to be very familiar with Luke's gospel. He quotes Luke in 1 Timothy 5:17 through 18 and 1 Corinthians 11:23 through 26. If Paul disagreed with Luke's account of the conception, we would expect to hear Paul say something about it in his letters. Paul never refuted or openly questioned the claims of Luke regarding the virgin conception. So Wallace's article is focusing on this issue, the virgin conception, but it ties into the whole nativity issue itself. You know, the virgin shall conceive and bring forth the son and how he was born and all of that. It all ties together. So you see his point here. His point is that, look, Paul knew Luke because he quoted him. Therefore, if Paul knew that Luke was teaching something that was untrue about Jesus' birth, virgin conception, birth, and so on, we would expect Paul to have mentioned it. And Paul just doesn't mention it. And then we have finally here, we have the three that we've already talked about. And then finally, Paul did mention Jesus' birth in Galatians chapter 4 when he is talking about the Judaizers and he is dealing with it, the false teaching of the Judaizers. And here's what he says. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. So here he is talking about Jesus being born of a woman. So clearly he knows Jesus was born of a woman. And what woman is that? Obviously that's Mary. And he's using this to support his claim that Jesus is the Christ and that there's no need to be under the law anymore. Jesus was born under the law to redeem those of us who are under it and cannot keep it. So he does mention, he does know Jesus is born of a woman. And from this, it's easy to conclude that he understood the rest of it as well. Now, let me make one final point on this because it comes up quite often in a lot of different spiritual contexts with the Bible. And that is the difference between modern Americans and what we think about and what we emphasize, and people in the ancient past in the Bible and what they thought was important and what they emphasized. And here's what I want to state about this. It is not fair to judge writers to be in error because they did not give emphasis on things we care about in the present. You see, that's what we're doing. We are going, gosh, the nativity is so important. Jesus' virgin birth is so important. And all these different things, we've got the things out, as we've mentioned, we've got them out in our lawns and we've got them at our churches, and all this is so important. Well, maybe to them, that wasn't as important as some other things. Now, of course, it is important, his virgin conception and all of that, and that's well documented in the New Testament. We've shown you that. But sometimes we look back at the Bible and we go, why didn't they talk about this? And the answer is, that's important to you. That's what you have made important. That's not necessarily what is important to those apostles or the first early Christians. The things we are fascinated with are not necessarily those of the men and women of the Bible. We cannot judge their accuracy or their knowledge based on something we think is really important and needs to be talked about by everybody all the time. We need to let the Bible authors and the Bible writers choose for themselves what they needed to talk about given their purpose and their particular ministry. So Paul, it's not a fair objection to say that Paul didn't know about the nativity because he didn't mention it in the way that we wanted him to. Now let's deal with this issue of the New Testament books. This is extremely common. Most people in the culture believe that the books that are in the New Testament were chosen and decided at what's called the Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea. This is a 16th century fresco depicting the Council of Nicaea. I found this online. How accurate it is, I don't know, but it's kind of a cool picture here. But the idea is that this council occurred, and at the council there were a bunch of different gospels that were circulating. There were a bunch of other books that were circulating. There were things called the Gnostic Gospels, which were gospels that were written by a particular heretical group of Christians or so-called Christians. There were other books. The church was always dealing with people writing books that were not legitimate, not from the apostles, not from the eyewitnesses. So what people believe in the culture is that at the Council of Nicaea, which was a Catholic council of bishops in 325 AD, that they decided, hey, look, we're going to keep out these gospels, we're going to keep out these other books, and we are only going to have this particular set of books in the New Testament. All right, I'm not going to go through tonight the way the early church determined which books they would accept and reject. I simply want to deal with this idea that those books were selected at the Council of Nicaea. According to Britannica.com, this is what it says about the council. This is the description of what was taking place at the Council of Nicaea. First Council of Nicaea, 325, the first ecumenical council of the Christian Church. Really, that's ecumenical council of the Catholic Church. But anyway, meeting in ancient Nicaea, now Iznik, Turkey. So this was in Turkey. It was called by the Emperor Constantine I, an unbaptized Catholic, who presided over the opening session and took part in the discussions. He hoped a general council of the church would solve the problem created in the Eastern Church by Arianism, a heresy first proposed by Arius of Alexandria that affirmed that Christ is not divine, but a created being. So Alexandria was in Egypt. So this heresy means false teaching. This false teaching had started to be developed in Egypt, that Jesus was not divine. He was not God. He was a created being. And this council was called, according to Britannica, to deal with this, primarily with this issue. This is a screenshot from the papal encyclicals online, your guide to online papal and other official documents of the Catholic Church. So this is where the Catholic Church keeps their official documents about councils and papal decrees, meaning the Pope, and all of that. So this is where I went to read it. You just Google official documents of Nicaea, and you'll get a bunch of lists, and they all come up to this kind of material. But so the official documents that were written and produced after that council are public knowledge. You can find those. You can read those. And here's what we find when we do the research. What was the results of this meeting of these bishops? First of all, they developed a profession of faith regarding the Trinity, known as the Nicene Creed. So if you've If you look up the Nicene Creed, it's going to talk about the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost, and that they're all God and they're of one substance, and so on and so on. It's really actually a fairly good description of the Trinity. All right, that came out of this council. And then there were 20 rules or laws that were known as canons. 20 canons, not canons like a gun, but canons as laws or rules. So after this was all over, they agreed on some stuff. And they agreed on 20 things. And you can go and read it. You can read it online. I didn't want to take all the time to read it now. But I did. I read every one of them. And they deal with all kinds of things. They deal with bishops, presbyters, deacons. They deal with rebaptism, loans, excommunication. And, of course, they deal with this thing regarding the Arians and this heresy. They also include at the end, they write a letter to the Egyptians, to the Alexandrian Christians, regarding Arius. So the whole thing here was to deal with this heresy and to get the churches straight on it. And this is what we find a lot of times, setting aside now that this is Catholicism, and Catholicism at this time was different than it is now, I'm sure. But a lot of times what you find in church history is that the truth is hammered out on the anvil of error. So there are errors that come up, and Christians have to go to the Word, and they have to research the Word, and then they have to develop the true teaching of the Bible. But it's coming from the fact that people are out there teaching heresy. For example, evolution. Evolution is an error, and the church has not done a good job of dealing with it. So many people, many Christians, and certainly all the atheists believe in it. But we are now, more and more people are hammering out from the Scriptures the truth about God in creation, the 6 days of creation, the millions of years and all that. You see what I mean? So we have to have this heresy come along so that we can hammer out the truth on that anvil of error. And this is really what had happened here. But what's most notable about this is what's missing in the official, all the documents that you can find that are official, never mention anything about selecting books of the Bible. There is a book written a number of years ago by Erwin Lutzer called The Da Vinci Deception. And this whole idea of Council of Nicaea really got popular when Dan Brown published his book, The Da Vinci Code. And he made the case in that book, and it's a fictional book, but he made the case that the Council of Nicaea kept certain Gospels out and kept certain ones in because they didn't want the truth about Jesus' relationship to Mary Magdalene, I believe it was Mary Magdalene, to come out. We could talk about that some other time. But that caused the church to do a lot of research. And Erwin Lutzer, who is a great, great writer and a very good scholar, he wrote a book called The Da Vinci Deception. He deals with this. Let's read what he says. He says, historical works on Nicaea give no evidence that Constantine and the delegates even discussed the Gnostic Gospels or anything that pertained to the canon. The Gnostic Gospels were the ones that were claiming that Mary and Jesus had a relationship, right? There's much to be said about that, but we're just talking now about Nicaea. He's saying, look, when you look at the historical works, all the stuff that's been published, they don't even mention the canon. He goes on, 20 rulings were issued at Nicaea, and the contents of all of them are still in existence, as I just showed you. Not one of them refers to the issues regarding the canon. Now let's pause for a moment. The skeptic's going to go, oh, they wouldn't publish that because they didn't want you to know. Well, why on earth at that time would they want to hide something that we now think is an issue? You see what I mean? We're 2,000 years later and we're looking back and we're making a claim. They wouldn't have even thought of that claim. They would have, if they had decided it, they would have published it. One of the things about these canons, I think it's the very first one, speaking about the church wanting to hide stuff. Let's say that the Catholic Church at the time wanted to hide the fact that they had determined that the Gnostic Gospel shouldn't be in the New Testament, okay? Well, the first canon deals with a bishop who has been castrated. Now, I'm not saying that to be crude. I'm simply saying that they talk about, if it's a natural castration, if someone else did it, if you did it to yourself, how do we deal with a bishop who's castrated himself? Now, if they're not going to hide that and, you know, kind of keep that on the down low, Why would they keep something like officially determining that the Gnostic Gospels were not valid out of the list? You see, it doesn't make any sense, and that's what Luther is saying. Let's go on. He has more to say. He says, thankfully, I was able to track down the source of the error, an anonymous document called Vetus Synodicum, written in about AD 887. Remember, the council is about 325, so this is roughly 550 years later, or almost 600 years later, devotes a chapter to each of the councils, the Council of Nicaea being one. However, the compiler adds details not found in the writings of historians. As for his account of Nicaea, he writes that the council dealt with matters of the divinity of Jesus, the Trinity, and the canon. So 550 years later, somebody is adding this discussion about the canon. Canon meaning the books of the Bible, the official list. That's what the canon means, okay? It's a collection, the collection of books. He writes, the canonical, and this is, he's quoting this 887 document. He writes, the canonical and apocryphal books it distinguished in the following manner. What he's saying is this is how the council figured out which books were to be in the New Testament and which were to be out of it. This is according to this 887 document, 550 years later. Now listen to how crazy this is. In the house of God, the books were placed down by the holy altar. So they took all the books, all the heretical books, all the normal books, and they put them down at the altar. Then the council asked the Lord in prayer that the inspired works be found on top. He's saying, Lord, here's a list, here's a stack of 57 books. Pick a number. All right, now here's what we're going to do. We're going to stack them in no particular order. And our prayer to you is that when we come back, the ones that are the right ones will be on the top and the bad ones will be on the bottom. Can you imagine somebody doing this? I mean, that's just a ridiculous thing, isn't it? And in fact, happened. In other words, he's saying, and that's what happened. We came back in the room and they were all organized and arranged. God showed us what the books were. Luther says, that quite obviously is the stuff of legend. No primary documents pertaining to Nicaea make reference to such a procedure. And then he finishes. This is a reminder, and this is the lesson for us. This is a reminder that legends are often confused with facts in such a way that the legends appear to replace the facts. And that's what's happened in our culture. We've heard this lie so long, and our preachers and our pastors and our teachers have not taught us the truth, so the only thing we can do is believe the lie, that we just take it and accept it as fact. When one presents history without consulting the sources, anything the mind can imagine can be written. What he's saying is, look, if you don't pay attention to the facts, you can come up with all kinds of crazy stuff that's just simply not true. And as we finish this session here of these three, let me just mention a lesson that I have learned, both as a former atheist and as somebody who has been able over the years to regularly engage with lost people and hear their objections. This is the lesson that I want to share with you that flows out of what we've studied this evening. Most of the reasons people don't believe the Bible, when carefully researched, are not valid arguments to begin with. They are very easily seen to be untrue. Almost all the arguments that atheists put forward over and over, there's a logical fallacy. And a logical fallacy is a false way of reasoning. There's a logical fallacy called the argument by verbosity or verbosity. And what it is when somebody, in order to make you feel like you're wrong and they're right, they will just simply list as many objections as they can in a row. I always thought of it as a shotgun, and that's what most lost people do. Well, what about Noah's Ark, and Jesus spoke a different language, and Paul didn't know about the divinity, and there are errors all over the Bible, and what about evolution? That's what's called argument by verbosity. They overwhelm you with so many objections that there's no way you can actually answer them, and they feel like they've won the argument. This is what people do. But most of the arguments that they have are not valid. They even simple basic research, I didn't have to do a lot of research here to figure this stuff out, would show them that their arguments are not sound. The truth about human beings is, this is where we get to the deeper truth. They don't want to believe. People who use that kind of a tactic, that kind of arguing, the argument by verbosity, don't want to believe. So they pile up arguments that justify that unbelief, regardless of the merit of those objections. They just don't care whether their arguments are true or not. They simply don't want to believe, and they're throwing everything they can at you so that they can look like they're right, and you can look like you're wrong. But their reasoning is false. Now, that does not mean that you don't answer those questions. What I do and what I did recently with the atheist that brought up a lot of these questions is I picked one thing and I gave him an answer on that. And then he accepted that. And then I picked another thing and I gave him an answer on that. That's how you deal with the argument by verbosity. You do one thing at a time over a long period of time, but you have to be respectful and you have to know your stuff. You have to be patient. But this is, people don't want to believe. So they throw out as much junk as they can. And so it is written, and the Jesus, our Lord Jesus himself said it. This is the condemnation. Light is coming to the world. The light of the Bible, the light of Jesus, the light of the New Testament is coming to the world. But men love darkness rather than light. They love these lies. They love these false objections because their deeds are evil and they simply don't want to believe. And so tonight, if you are watching this or if you watch this video in the future, are you one of these people? Are you actually listening and trying to find the truth? Or are all you are doing is throwing as much mud against the wall as you can to obscure the fact that you just hate God and you hate Christians and you hate the Bible? And you just don't want to believe. If you can come to the realization one way or the other on that, you will have come a long way.